Texas Parks and Wildlife Podcast, providing an exclusive look into efforts to conserve the wild things and wild places in Texas.
I'm Lydia Saldana with Texas Parks and Wildlife Foundation, and I'm pleased to be here at the Dallas Zoo for the 5th annual State of Conservation Dinner hosted by the Dallas Chapter of the Stewards of the Wild. We've got three dedicated conservationists with us here tonight, and we'll be recording this conversation for the Texas Parks and Wildlife podcast so that others outside this area can also listen in. Let's start with introductions. And Harrison, I'm going to start with you.
Sure, absolutely. I'm Harrison Adele. I'm the Vice President of Animal Operations and Welfare here at Dallas Zoo. So I'm responsible for husbandry, care, conservation programming that affects the 2,000 animals that live here at the zoo, 6,000 animals at Children's Aquarium at Fair Park, as well as some of our conservation programs cooperatively elsewhere.
Okay. I'm Annie Brown, Executive Director with Texas Parks and Wildlife Foundation. We're the philanthropic arm of Texas Parks and Wildlife Department and thrilled to be here with our Stewards of the Wild chapter.
And I'm Joe Crafton, and I'm with Collectors Covey. And if you don't know, we sell wildlife art, hunting and fishing, shotguns, and other stuff that you need for your house. And cabin. And,
you know. Okay, so Harrison, you said you take care of those animals. So did you teach those flamingos how to dance?
I did. That was me. Yeah. We have an incredible team of animal keepers, animal caretakers, nutritionists, et cetera. So you guys got a chance to meet earlier tonight some of the ambassador animals that come out to meet kids in classrooms, meet guests here at the zoo, flamingos, tamanduay anteaters, tegu lizards, et cetera. So
yeah,
it's an incredible collection.
That lizard from Argentina was incredibly cool. The okapi that I didn't know that giraffes had cousins, right? Did we learn that tonight? Giraffes have cousins. So that was very, very cool. Of course, seeing the hippo exhibit was really awesome. Now, this audience in particular is incredibly interested in Texas conservation. And I know we've talked about some of the conservation projects that the Dallas Zoo is involved in, and particularly Texas conservation projects. Tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, absolutely. Dallas Zoo is one of the accredited zoos in the U.S. So of the 2,500 zoos that are licensed by USDA to operate in the U.S., there are fewer than 230 that are accredited by the Association of Zoos and Aquariums. As one of those accredited zoos, we participate in a number of collaborative, cooperative breeding and conservation programs. So there are just under 600 species survival plans in the U.S., Canada, and Mexico. Of those 600, we participate in about 200 of those here at Dallas Zoo. So we coordinate some of them. We participate by working with the individual species themselves. For some of those species, we're managing them with the goal of building a self-sustaining population in the states as a backup for conservation programs in the wild. For some of those species, we are actually breeding animals to release them into the wild to bolster wild populations. And in terms of Texas species specifically, we're really involved with a number of different species. Ocelots are a cause near and dear to our heart. They used to be all over Texas, and there are very few of them in the states anymore. We had talked specifically about Texas horned lizards. We love them. Are there TCU fans in the crowd?
Maybe
it's a good
a
guess.
Few.
It's
we
a
are
good guess
Dallas.
That there might be a couple. So Texas horned lizards are a pet project of ours. We've been working on them for years now. We are a participant in the Texas horned lizard species survival plan, whereby we're breeding horned lizards in zoos with the goal of reintroducing them into the wild. We're not to the point of reintroducing them yet, but we've been involved out at Rolling Plains, which you guys know of, I think.
Quail Research Ranch, yeah.
Yeah, we're going to talk about that some more. You know what, when we talked earlier, and one of the things that fascinated me the most about the work that your staff is doing is that, you know, we all know about zoos as places to visit animals, conservation, education that's happening, but I was struck by the on-the-ground research that your staff is doing at the Rolling Plains Quail Research Ranch. Tell me a little more about that.
Yeah, that was a site that we started work at in 2010. So we're going on 8 years of research out there with horned lizards specifically. We've been tracking individual horned lizards for years. And so our herpetologists from the zoo travel out there a couple of times a year. We do site surveys to understand habitat and how the lizards are using the habitat. We literally tag every individual lizard that we come across, which
little
allows us to track
tags,
them
right?
from year to year to year. They're very tiny tags, about the size of a grain of rice.
Yeah.
And with some of those lizards, we actually are tracking the same individual in the same home range for a couple of years at a time. So it allows us to better understand the way the animals interact with the environment, the food sources that are most important to them, growth rates, et cetera, which sets us up to succeed when we are ready to actually look at reintroduction for that species into the wild. So, you know, horned lizards, a lot of folks who grew up in Texas saw them in their backyards. Yeah. Their populations have dropped by 30 to 40% in a lot of places, and we really don't understand why. So the opportunity to try and bolster some of those populations with captive bred lizards is really appealing. So we're working towards that.
And, of course, you mentioned the Rolling Plains Quail Research Ranch, which is the perfect segue to Joe Crafton. Joe, many here in this room know the story of Park City's quail and the connection to the research ranch, but some of our podcast listeners might not. Can you share the Park City's quail story?
I'd be glad to. Well, it started with a desire to be plugged into a community. So I moved here in 2000, and I didn't know that many people, and I really wanted to go quail hunting, and I heard about these mythical quail hunts with 20 coveys a day. And so without knowing anybody and not having a Stewards of the Wild, we didn't have that in 2006. And I've aged out now, but now that I see Phil Lamb out there, I'm encouraged that maybe, you know, you keep moving the date that you age out. And maybe I'm not aged out. But so we didn't have a way to plug ourselves in. So we tried to start a chapter of Quail Unlimited. And they didn't have a chapter here, so after some persuasion, we started it. And then we decided that really all the money could stay in Texas. We had this wonderful quail research ranch that the Mellon Foundation had given us $5 million to build a research ranch of our very own with our own graduate students in this fabulous facility. So why are we sending our money to the national headquarters when we could, which they took half, they took 50% of our take? So the first year we announced that we were going to be independent and start our own 501c3. Instead of raising $50,000, $60,000, which is traditional, we raised $850,000 the first year. So,
and Joe, you said, I remember in our first conversation, you said, if it's to be, it's up to me.
Well, it, certainly the sportsmen have the greatest track record of saving wildlife, and 75% of dollars from conservation come from sportsmen, whether it be the Pittman-Robinson Act. And we redistributed $14 billion from license fees and hunting fees and ammo fees, and it gets sent back to the states. And so the story of the turkey, the story of the deer, the story of the ducks or migratory birds, they've all been because sportsmen didn't wait for the government to figure out their problem or solve their problem. They took it in their own hands. And so that's been the attitude. We've never taken a dollar from any government agency. And we have energized our crowd. So we now have statewide 5,000 members. We raise over $1 million a year. And it was all grassroots, and it's we have 25 volunteers. Some of them are here tonight.
Yeah,
that it's all volunteer driven. So it's really an amazing story of sportsmen just not going to sit there and in their rocking chair one day and say, "I wish I'd done something." We're going to do something. We may not solve the problem, but we're making great progress.
Well, and that's very much what the stewards are all about.
Absolutely, and I wish we had this group in 06. We'd have mobilized it. We'd probably made $800,000 the first year instead of waiting for the second year.
That's awesome. Now, and Brown has been on the Texas conservation scene for what?
A long time.
And what is your impression of the impact that Park City's quail has had on quail conservation?
So I called our good friend Kelly Thompson.
Yeah, Kelly comes
wanted to
every year.
Have some of his opinions on it as well. So I think it is an example, though, in Texas Parks and Wildlife, the same as you just said, Joe, believes 100% that hunters are the best conservationists in the world. I mean, hunting, angling, whatever you do outdoors, they're at the top of the pyramid. And Park City's quail really has transformed, and especially I think for North Texas, but for the whole state, how people can look at a dedicated group of conservationists who are hunters getting together and solving a problem through what they're doing. I mean, with $1 million, I mean, you guys almost raise $1 million every year.
Pretty much.
$7 million to date, right?
Mm-hmm.
Putting that into research and youth education. I think you've raised the bar, and especially for quail in Texas, with $11 million coming in from the quail coalitions together, of what dedicated, again, hunters and anglers can do when they want to make a difference in the state. So.
Well, thank you for that. We certainly are proud of it, and we appreciate the support we get from all the nonprofits. It's like you see Dallas Safari Club there, you see the Parks and Wildlife Foundation, you look around, and we call it conservation's greatest night. We're kind of humble around there, but we call it conservation's greatest night, and we make the national news about every other year with people like Tom Brokaw and Ted Turner and George Strait. We have some really great speakers that pay their own expenses to get there, and sometimes they even buy items in the live auction, so it's a nice It's a nice way to go.
Good deal.
And it has I don't want to stop. So it has energized, though, on the quail front, so everybody knows. So now we're going to have a West Texas quail biologist dedicated at the department, which we've never had before.
Fantastic.
A quail license plate. And I know our South Texas quail hunters aren't here tonight, so I can say this. It sort of shows that North Texas...
it matters.
It matters in quail, so...
Yeah, well, thank you for that. And that was funded by the Parks and Wildlife Foundation, who gave the money to the state. Otherwise, there wouldn't have been the funds to do that. So we have our own focus, and I know that was something you championed. We appreciate it, Annie.
You know, Annie, I've been involved with Parks and Wildlife for many, many years before working for the Parks and Wildlife Foundation. But what has struck me since I've begun working for the foundation is your mantra of raising all the ships. And it really does seem like there's more collaboration than ever. There's more of a emphasis, again, on raising all the boats so we can achieve the most. Talk to me a little bit about that.
So the foundation always has had that sort of focus on good conservation raises everybody's boats. But I think one of the things that did happen that really motivated and sort of moved everybody forward, unfortunately, was the Deepwater Horizon spill. But what came out of that was all of the BP funding that's out there right now. So in Texas, for example, there's going to be about $700 million that's going to be put on the Texas coast for conservation. And to put it bluntly, NGOs had to get their act together and they had to partner because those proposals, whether it's through Restore Act or National Fish and Wildlife Foundation, all of that was focused on collaboration. And I think that's really made NGOs, when I say that, non-governmental agencies, nonprofits, really think about the best way to make conservation happen for everybody is to work together. So that was transformational, and again, for us in Texas, but I think across the entire coast.
And Joe, I'd like to just ask you, do you feel like, I mean, all the folks that have been involved with Park City's quail, do you feel like hunters feel like they have more of a say in things by getting us involved?
I think they can. You know, there's very little competition among conservation groups. And we talk about quail being the leading indicator of the health of a ranch or a farm, and they call it the canary of the prairie. You may have heard that. But we see what's good for sage grouse or Atwater's prairie chicken or whatever the species is. It's great because we're really competing against apathy, and we're competing against ignorance, because the average school kid, you know, asking where the food comes from, they say a grocery store. They don't say a farm or a ranch. And they think a carrot is about that big around and smooth all the way around. They don't really process that somebody had to grow it, somebody had to take care of it. And hunting and fishing in general has been flat to declining. I think there's 30 million licensed hunters in the U.S., and they went from 300,000 in Texas quail hunters to less than 50,000 a few years ago. So we have to worry about that generational change. So I think we're all pulling together. We've supported things that weren't related specifically to quail because it just having wild places is great for the whole state and it's great for everybody.
Yeah. And, you know, what we've been talking about here is the power of philanthropy. And I've mentioned to a few folks that I haven't been to the Dallas Zoo since my daughter was very, very young. And she's 31 now. And I can't believe the transformation. You know, what we walked into today, just what we saw. And my understanding in talking to you and Greg was that was powered by philanthropy. You want to talk a little bit about that, about the role of philanthropy in what zoos are able to offer to the public?
Yeah, absolutely. Are there other folks in the audience who maybe visited Dallas Zoo in the past and haven't been here for years? Yeah. A lot of you, yeah. So... That's the common trend when I interact with folks in Dallas. A lot of people say, I went there as a kid, or I went there when my kids were kids, but I haven't been there in 20 years, and this is a very different place. So we privatized essentially almost 8-9 years ago now. This was a city-operated zoo for a long time, and so, you know, when budget got short and we're in competition with a number of different city agencies for the same funds, it gets real tough to justify feeding animal mouths over police funding or repair needs across the city. So when we privatized and we are now operated by a nonprofit, it changes the game dramatically. So for us, philanthropy and strategic partnerships are crucial. It's absolutely crucial to what we do. When we're working on a specific project, there are partners that we'll reach out to, and similar to what you mentioned, there have been species that we don't work with here at the zoo, but for which we've partnered with partners who made sense to move conservation forward. And I love the phrase battling apathy, because that's exactly what we're dealing with as well. You know, 80% of Americans, per the last census, live in urban areas instead of rural areas. So the fact that you have city kids who grow up their entire lives without ever interacting with a quail, they're not connected to nature. For us, that makes a really compelling story to tell when we're dealing with philanthropy and we're approaching someone to talk about partnering a conservation project or an exhibit. Simmons Hippo Outpost that you guys spent time in earlier tonight was our largest project that was funded by individual giving. It's a $14 million project that we completed specifically to tell the story of hippos, African wetland habitats, okapi. Some of you got to connect with those species tonight, and that's really the goal for us too. We want those 1.2 million guests that walk through the Dallas Zoo in a year to connect with wildlife, connect with nature, and potentially turn that into conservation action, whether that's going into that environment and interacting with it, whether that's being more involved philanthropically with other partnerships or organizations, but definitely taking action once they've left here to make some difference in the world.
Okay. I'm going to ask each of you a couple of specific questions, and this one is for you, Annie. The video we showed at the top of the program provided an overview of the progress that we've made on the Keeping It Wild campaign, which is the biggest fundraising effort ever undertaken by the foundation. Where are we on that?
So I'm going to give that, but I want to do mention one thing to the folks so they understand. In the philanthropy world, conservation actually gets the smallest piece of the pie. So when you look at what people give to, they give to everything else, and we get the smallest piece. So we also have to work together strategically. Yeah. Because it's really about leveraging our relationships and the philanthropy that we have. So I also think that's a big piece.
Absolutely.
And again, on the species, you can't single species work. You have to work across species, and I want to make sure folks understand that. So the campaign, the foundation launched the campaign in 2014. It was a $100 million goal. We're past $90 million on it. One of the things that's unique about the campaign is that all of the money that we raise in the campaign is to go directly on the ground for conservation outcomes. None of that's for operations, none of that's for administration. It's a 100% on the ground putting money back into Texas. So we've raised, like I said, $90 million. Of that, we've protected about 20,000 acres of critical coastal habitat, Powderhorn Ranch on the coast, another ranch that's just a little bit west of Fort Worth. We've put two reefs on the coast, artificial reefs, working with CCA and our Shell partner, which is about 361-acre area, so significant in Port O'Connor. Right now, after Hurricane Harvey, it's a huge benefit because to make that economy work, people have to get back fishing, and our reefs make a difference in that. So also conservation's all about helping economies. We've also worked on partnerships, restoring pronghorn in West Texas with our partnership at Borderland Research Institute. On the quail front, we've endowed a quail chair in honor of Kelly Thompson, and his daughter Molly's here tonight, for awesome quail work that they're doing. We funded the quail position for the next 5 years at Texas Parks and Wildlife. So we've touched every corner of Texas is what we do. We've stocked 1 million native species, Guadalupe bass and Texas rivers. So anything I think that people love, wild places, wild things, our campaign has touched. And it's put directly on the ground. So we're thrilled with where we are. We've got about $8 million left, and we'll get there. So that's what we've done.
That's awesome. Now, of course, y'all know, right? But some of the folks listening may not know that Stewards of the Wild is a young professionals organization that started right here in Dallas. And it really took off from there. The momentum is growing. It's grown across the state. We have more than 800 members. And I'd like to ask each of y'all, how do y'all think that this organization can achieve positive change for conservation in Texas? And I'd like each of you to respond to that. And I'm going to start with you, Joe. How can stewards get involved in positive change for conservation?
So Texas is unique in a lot of ways. 95% privately owned, maybe 96. So the government can't affect that much wildlife. You can buy islands, you can buy research ranches, you can do some things, but what we really have to do is get the private landowners to have a conservation ethic, right? I can plow every inch of this and put it in cotton. I can put hundreds of head of cattle on my farm or ranch. But being aware that there's some things they can do where agriculture and and wildlife can live in harmony. And economically, I mean, a ranch that has one quail per acre is worth a lot more than a ranch that has one quail for every 100 acres. And so you can drive through the country in Texas, and you see the people that have a conservation ethic, and you see the people that don't. And they're maximizing their agriculture, and they're business people. I know that. But stewards of the wild, you guys are the future. Y'all are the future landowners, the future friends of landowners. And social pressure is one of the highest, strongest pressure out there. And I think praising people that are doing the right things for the wildlife, for the future, you know, whether it be the ocelot or the quail or a deer, that's the kind of thing that education is a big part of it. It's not just buying land and buying research and paying for scientists. It's changing the private landowner's mind about what the sweet spot is between maximizing your cattle and your cotton, but also maximizing your rental income from hunters or your sales, resale value of a ranch. I'd love to have a ranch that has a quail per acre, and I'm shopping for one now. So, you know, it drives prices up, and I can tell you that same thing is true for deer and other wildlife. So,
yeah. Annie?
So I want to make sure that I think Mac is here, Mac McFarlane, and Josh. So Mac and Josh actually came to us, the foundation, with the idea to start a stewards group, and it was going to be a young professionals group, and we really looked at what that meant and what it was going to be, and we really wanted to make sure it wasn't focused on this wasn't a fundraising group, that's all they were going to do, because a lot of young professional groups get distracted in that. This was really going to be a group that would engage in our home ground in Texas. And we were going to really focus on making sure that you had every opportunity, not only to learn about the foundation, but again, to float all conservation boats and learn about Park City's quail, learn about Texas Wildlife Association, learn about the zoo, learn about anything that inspires you. So our real mission for stewards is to make sure that whatever turns you on from a wildlife perspective, that you get inspired by it and engaged in it, and you become a leader in it. Because I will tell you, I mean, I look at the numbers we get all the time about hunters, and I mean, the latest study from the service is it's down 18%. I mean, on the fishing side, it's about even. It's not anglers are kind of not. It's a little easier to be a, I think, to go fish, and their numbers look a little better. But we all talk about every day. I mean, folks just are not getting out. And it's, I know it's soccer weekend, I've got an 8-year-old, I understand that, but I do think we have a responsibility, and that's what our stewards groups are here to remind you about, is to make sure that whatever outdoor experience you enjoy, to make sure that you're inspired by it and engaged with it, and I hope that our chapters all think about that when they start working with us.
Thanks, Annie. Harrison?
I'm going to echo some of what you guys are saying. I think inspiration is key. I think everyone in this audience and those of us up here had some interaction or some experience when we were younger that for us made an impact and drew some connection between us and nature and the environment and being out in the wild. We keep seeing migration to urban areas, away from rural areas. We keep seeing kids that we interact with here at the zoo who are less connected to wildlife. And if the goal is to build empathy for animals, even if that means using an individual species that they're connected to try and build on that and let that snowball into something that's a bigger action or a bigger empathy for the environment, that's what we're in the business of trying to do. But the question is, you know, for those of you here who are engaged in some way, are you vocal enough about that the people that you interact with are learning that from you, and perhaps are you giving them the opportunity for that to rub off on them? If you are interacting with nieces and nephews, are you content to take them down the street to the park, or are you talking your brothers and sisters and throwing them in the back of the station wagon and driving out somewhere and taking them camping for a weekend instead? Is there an opportunity to do that? Awareness is really key. It drives us up a wall when we interact with guests at a zoo who are just not connected to animals, because it's a challenge. But any opportunity you have to turn that into a lifelong connection to nature, we've got to take. I mean, that's a given. I mean, I think that could be potentially a room to always improve on.
And Harrison, I talked to a few folks today, and several with small children, right? A lot of y'all have small children because you're at that place in your life. And several of them said, we're members of the Dallas Zoo. We're here all the time, which is awesome. It's really awesome to hear. Now, Joe, I we could talk about your resume. We could probably talk for 45 minutes about what's on your resume.
Right here,
but we're
right
here
now.
In Dallas. We're here in Dallas. Yep. And I know you're very involved with the Trinity Park Conservancy.
Right.
Give us a brief
Yeah, so where we are, so I think the cycle works like, you know, you get somebody takes you in the outdoors, and then you fall in love with the outdoors, and then you, maybe you start hunting, and then you get mad at them, and you do like I didn't get the gun with the extended magazine, so you can shoot like 100 at a time, and then you mellow out, and then you just become a nature lover. And so I'm kind of both. I love to hunt, but I also love nature in general. And so the Trinity Park Conservancy and really another group that's called Texan by Nature, which Miss Laura Bush started, mm-hmm. are two nature groups that are really taking ownership of their own backyard. So the Trinity River, if you drove over here, you probably saw the Margaret Hunt Hill Bridge and the Margaret Montgomery Bridge, the big white bridges. And in between those two, there's 180 acres that we're planning on spending $150 million. And we're going to rechannel the river so that it's not a big drainage ditch. It's going to have a serpentine wind to it. And we're going to naturalize the river largely and bring in and make it so that it's an estuary for wildlife and great blue herons and egrets and all that comes with it. And trying to bring that into the city. The city. So instead of a ditch that separates the city east and west, it's going to be a place for people to embrace nature. So we're going to start our fundraising on that. Everybody's raising money these days, but you know, it is a private partnership, and it's modeled off of the Dallas Zoo. The Dallas Zoo mm-hmm. privatized 8 years ago, and it worked. This is one of the highest ranked zoos in the country now, and it wasn't because federal government or the state or city taxpayers did. It's because people gave money for something they cared about. So we're going to do the same thing with the Trinity Park Conservancy. And then Texan by Nature, if I can get a plug in for that.
Yeah, absolutely.
Go to the website, texanbynature.org. But Miss Laura Bush started that, and she has challenged us to the 96% of Texas that's privately owned, for us to take care of our own, keeping the wild places wild and planting beneficial grasses and natural grasses and doing the right things for the environment. So two of them that I'd say, you know, you start, somebody takes you hunting or camping and you get the bug, and it can lead to all kinds of things. And I would say you have more time on your hands than you think you do. These groups need volunteers. They really do. And when we started Park City's Quail, none of us took out their wallets and started spending a bunch of money. We just gave our time and our network. And so I would say, you know, find a group like that you can get involved in locally or statewide or nationally.
I could talk to y'all for another hour, but I know we don't have another hour, and I want to give time for y'all to have questions too. But I do want to ask a couple of, just kind of wrap it up with a couple of questions. And first of all, I would just say that, you know, Harrison, when we talk about conservation, what we're really talking about is the legacy that we're going to be leaving for future generations. What's the legacy that the Dallas Zoo wants to leave?
Oh, good question. We pride ourselves on building a better world for animals. And our CEO will tell you that applies whether we're talking about elephants in Africa or gorillas in Central African rainforest, or whether we're talking about animals right here in Texas. So for us, it's twofold. It's hands-on conservation. It's conservation in the field, measuring horned lizards and trying to learn about a species. It's conservation that we base here at the zoo, building populations of animals that we can utilize for future efforts and that we use as ambassadors. And it's trying to convert 1.2 million guests a year to turn them into nature lovers so that they grow up more active in environmental causes, more likely to engage with an NGO, more likely to vote to protect an environmental resource that matters. So for us, that's what drives us every day.
Well, so Annie, following up on a $100 million campaign might be daunting to some, but we know you. What's next for Parks and Wildlife Foundation?
I'm going to take a sabbatical. No, I'm just kidding.
Not.
So we're, in 2018, building on the success of Stewards of the Wild, we're actually going to focus a lot more on a public awareness campaign where our stewards group are really about quality experiences, and it's going to be called We Will Not Be Tamed. It'll launch in March of 2018. We're going to work with our brand partners, Texas Monthly, Yeti, Rocket Buster, Howler Brothers, a number of Diablo, everything Texas Essential. We call it our Texas Essential Kit, so all of the best-made products in Texas. And we're going to highlight 10 folks from across the state and how they engage and what they love. So we've got JT Van Zandt, who's going to be on his, you know, he's going to be fly fishing. We've got the Diablo owner is going to be doing his thing. We've got bow hunting with Jordan Shipley. We've got a myriad of opportunities that we're going to highlight in the state to get everybody to be inspired about what they want to do when they're outside, so you can look for it in 2018.
Pretty exciting. Okay, before we open this up for questions, I do have one more question for Joe. And, of course, Joe, you serve on the executive committee of the Board of Directors for the Boy Scouts of America,
yep,
which, of course, recently made headlines with the decision to open up Scouts to girls. I also understand you are working on a new scouting project that will impact future generations of Scouts. Can you give us a little bit of insight as we close this
up? How much time do you have?
2 minutes, baby, 2 minutes.
So, yes, so the Boy Scouts, I'm very excited about that. We have 3 million Boy Scouts in the U.S., 1 million volunteers, and we are the original Green organization, right? 107 years of Green Army out there camping and hiking and shooting guns. We've done 2 million merit badges just in shotgun merit badge and rifle merit badge. So we have taught a lot of people to shoot safely and enjoy the outdoors. So that's very close to my heart. And the other thing we're doing with Boy Scouts is we're embracing hunting big time. And so instead of kind of keeping this politically correct distance from it, we built the second largest shooting range in the country up in West Virginia, our high adventure base called the Summit. And we built a Hunter's Hall. And at Hunter's Hall, they go through and they see the heritage of Boy Scouts in hunting and the heritage of all the merit badges. And then they see how sportsmen saved ducks and deer and quail and hopefully quail one day and turkey. So we are embracing that. And so that's positive news because we do have boys and girls. Four of our six programs offer and always have always offered for girls. We're so strongly branded, people think Boy Scouts, it's all boys, but we have four out of our six programs have always included girls. We have never had a program for ages. We have two programs that are for young people. One's Scout Reach for inner city kids, and the other one's called STEM program. But our mainstream program, we've always locked girls out, said you can't join because, to a certain degree, out of respect for other girl organizations, but we weren't, the families have changed a lot. So we're trying to serve the whole family. A lot of our busy families, 80% of the women work in the workplace, the moms. And so instead of dropping the kids off, they want to go to a place where they can participate. So Cub Scouts, it's very non-gender Cub Scouts. If you've ever been to a Cub Scout meeting, you realize how non-gender it is.
I have four brothers. Yep, I've been to a Cub Scouts meeting.
you probably went to some Cub Scout
meetings. Yes, indeed.
So we've always been family camping. So it really is not pursuing another organization. It's just unlocking a door that's been locked. And we think the leadership program, the outdoor program, is a real positive. 80% of our survey participants voted in favor of the change. So we're really excited about the change and trying to make that in August of next year. So we're almost 12 months away.
And that is the future.
That is the future. And so I'm stoked about what we're doing there. And I can't remember your other question. Was that the only question?
That was it.
Okay.
You got it.
So one thing I hope that you get out of this is wherever you've been planted, wherever God put you, so this is your post, you can influence your group. Even if you have a professional career like I did for 30 years of corporate America, I was doing some of these things while I was in it. It just takes an hour here, an hour there, using your network, bringing people to a meeting, and being an evangelist for what we're doing here, because it's a shrinking, passionate group. And if our forefathers hadn't protected ducks in 1936 with the North American Conservation Act, right, we wouldn't have duck hunting. Right. And I owe it to them. And I'm going to pay it forward because my grandkids are going to be able to do it. And if it's up to me, if I have anything to do with it. So give what you can. And it may start off small like this little club we started in Dallas, and it could end up something significant.
And, of course, that's what Stewards is all about.
Absolutely.
And with that, I'll open it up to questions. Who has a question? Okay, right here.
A little off topic maybe, but how did the new elephants get here?
Okay, and I'm going to repeat the question for our podcast audience. This gentleman wants to know, how did the elephants get here? Did I get that right?
Okay. Yes.
Yeah, so 90% of the animals that you meet in a zoo were born in a zoo. We have one select group of elephants that live here at Dallas that were born in southern Africa. So it's been a year and a half or so since their arrival. We had partnered with two other zoos in originally a conservation project that was focused on rhinos in southern Africa. There's a tiny country, landlocked Swaziland, that's right in the middle of South Africa itself. They had national parks that were amazing habitat for endangered rhinos, but which were overrun with elephants. And they had done a great job protecting elephants from poachers in Swaziland, but the upside of the shadow of that was that this population of elephants boomed. Elephants take a lot of resources, so they were eating themselves out of house and home. Habitat was very quickly becoming less appealing for rhinos and other endangered animals, so we offered this as a space for those elephants to come to, in lieu of being culled in Swaziland. So there were two other zoos that partnered with us. Five adult elephants came here. 17 elephants on one plane. It's a very large plane.
Wow, landed, really? Were you on that plane?
I was here to meet the plane when it arrived. Great photos of the plane.
You got the cleanup.
Yeah, I luckily, because we were the first stop and it stopped at two other zoos, the third zoo had to do the cleanup of the plane, which was fine with us. Those elephants have settled in, have been introduced to elephants that already lived here. So our herd of elephants includes 9 adult elephants as well as 1 little calf that was born a few months after that. Awesome. It was a surprise baby. It was an oops baby. Who turned a year old on Mother's Day. And so our herd of elephants now ranges from about a year old to 41 years, which is a really nice intergenerational herd, which is kind of what you would see in Africa too. They interact and act very naturally, and we saw lots of really cool natural behaviors in our retired circus elephants that we had never seen before they were introduced to elephants that came from the wild. So it's been a really rewarding year and a half.
Very cool.
It's been a great project. So
awesome question. Great information. Okay, another question? Okay, back here?
On the quail conservation, this
yep.
is really awesome. I hadn't heard about this.
Yep.
So what are you doing about fire ants?
So the question
Let
is, what are we doing
about
fire ants?
Let me repeat the question, Joe. Oh, go ahead. You just did.
Yeah,
go
just
ahead.
What are we doing at quail research about fire ants? Well, the best resource I can give you in a short amount of time is go to quailresearch.org. And what they've done is chase down a lot of myths, because I always grew up hearing certain things were affecting, you know, turkey were eating quail, or, you know, other things. And they've done a lot of myth-busting with research. So the great thing about having your own ranch is you put these tiny little tags on them, and you can determine their mortality by examining their death. We've seen them in the middle of snakes. We've seen these radio collars up at the top of a tree where a hawk ate them to pieces. And we know what killed them, and we've done tests and controls with fire ants. The best research is at Tall Timbers in North Florida, where they studied the proximity to fire ants with the survival of the chick. And there's some, it's a wash. There's not really a problem. Matter of fact, quail babies only eat bugs, and so some of them were eating those fire ants. So I think the rise of the fire ants, so here's what's interesting, rise of the fire ants and the decline of the quail kind of were coterminous. And what it really was, farming practices changed about the same time fire ants came in, and people went to clean farming with bug killer and weed killer, and that's what quail needs. So it turns out to be, at least the current thinking is, it's not a factor in quail. And that's what the research tells you. Otherwise, you go to the coffee shop and the old men tell you what's wrong with the quail, and you spend all your time chasing old men stories.
You know? Okay. Okay, another question? What a great conversation. Is there somebody out there? Oh, there we go.
Yeah, so sorry, let me make sure I'm understanding the question. How do we decide which species we are that we're focusing on in terms of reintroduction efforts? That's complicated. There's a lot of stakeholders for every reintroduction program. So if you're talking about red wolves on the East Coast, obviously there's a lot of people who care a lot about a wolf being reintroduced into native habitat and whether there's enough habitat for it to live here and what that impact is going to look like. I'm not saying we took the easy route, but horned lizards are pretty cute and nobody really objects to them being down the road. So that's an easy target for reintroduction. Who's involved in this? Who has a stake in this? How is this going to affect everybody that's involved with a particular habitat or environment? For something like horned lizards, we worked really closely with Texas Parks and Wildlife to identify a couple of key species that herpetologists on their team thought were not on anybody's radar. So horned lizards are one of the species, but Brazos River water snakes and reticulate collared lizards and a couple other Texas native species were ones that Texas Parks and Wildlife, in meetings with us, said, you know what, we'd love for somebody to deal with that thing, figure out what's going on with Brazos River water snakes, because we can't, we're doing some research, but we'd love partners on this. This goes back to strategic partnerships. So, you know, the communication between NGOs and between different stakeholders helps us to identify what species we're going to focus on. And then there's a whole lot of other preparation that goes into that before you can actually turn something loose. So it's not easy, but
I'd love to comment on that. Not to take away from anything, but you do realize that the gas that goes in the tank is hunting, because if you have a fundraiser for horned lizards, you're not going to get a raise $1 million. So a lot of the hunters in the room and the shooters of the wild can take pleasure in the fact that Parks and Wildlife runs off hunting fees and hit and run. So they need us and we need you. So the species that get the most attention are the ones. Theodore Roosevelt said that only wild creatures will only live at all if anybody has a vested interest in them, and hunters have the greatest vested interest because we have no hobby without our animals. So the ducks, the quail, the deer, the huntable species are pulling the train, and then we have the benefit of these other animals riding on that train. Not to take anything away from what you're talking about, but the hunters can be proud that we're the ones that are making all that possible.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
And a lot of that through Pittman Robertson dollars. So every time you buy a firearm or ammunition, those dollars come back down to the states, and that's what the Texas Parks and Wildlife Department actually will put out in research dollars on the ground. And that makes it all happen as well.
Yeah, so. And then the critical piece of that, Annie, is that there has to be a match to that. And that's the role that the Parks and Wildlife Foundation plays, whether it's pronghorn research or grasslands. It's bringing those private dollars for the match that makes that happen, that leverages those dollars. Any other questions? We could stay here for another hour easily, right? But I know that there is a raffle that's going to happen here in just a minute. And really appreciate the conversation with all of y'all.
Thank you, Lydia.
And we really appreciate everything you're doing for the wild things and wild places of Texas. Thank you.
Texas Parks and Wildlife Podcast is brought to you by Texas Parks and Wildlife Foundation, supporting high-impact conservation projects across the state. Find out how you can help at tpwf.org.